History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The most well-known effects of the Civil War were the defeat of the Confederacy and the Emancipation Proclamation. Along with the reorganization of the United States, it was led by a stronger central government, making it more centralized. And you can see this in little things such as the United States being referred to singularly, not plural. Instead of a politician saying the United States are, they would say the United States is. But an overlooked result of the Civil War that's arguably just as influential as these is the financing of the Civil War. Not only did the Lincoln government establish a national banking system to pay for it, before this, there were just a bunch of state banks that basically issued IOU notes to people that acted as currency. They invented a paper currency much like ours, and many other things that broadened the government's involvement in the lives of ordinary Americans. The Transcontinental Railroad, the Homestead Act, the Morrill Act, which endowed land-grant colleges for the middle class, and basically created the template for American higher education that was copied all over the world. The government also issued help for farmers, the state's role in immigration, a new system of taxes, which included for the first time income tax. Lincoln and his fellow Republicans created a new notion of what government could do. Larger, more proactive, more responsible for the national welfare. He and his allies had been fighting for his agenda for years, and until the war had been on the losing side. But what Lincoln wanted was for the government to promote opportunity for others like himself. That is, for pioneers, poor settlers, and remote Western farmers. Today's guest is Roger Lowenstein, author of the new book, Ways and Means, Lincoln, His Cabinet, and the Financing of the Civil War. We discuss how Lincoln used the urgency of funding the Civil War to accomplish a series of far-reaching government reforms. This fundamentally changed what people thought the U.S. government could be, larger, more proactive, and more responsible for the national welfare. We also look at how this project failed. Many of the problems and horrors of Reconstruction had to do with Black Americans being marginalized from these spoils, and how a system of segregation was maintained after the Civil War. So this is a new examination of the transformation of the United States in the 19th century. It also shows how extraordinary reform can happen during wartime. I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Roger Lowenstein. Roger, welcome to the show.
Scott, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
So for people like myself who have a limited understanding of America's economic history, I know some of the main points, like the founding of the Federal Reserve in 1913 and the expansion of the federal government during the Progressive Era. This is a watershed moment, but this isn't the first large change that happens. It's not as if we had the same system from America's founding until the early 20th century. So one of the big changes is what you explain at length in your book is what Abraham Lincoln inaugurated. Broadly speaking, what system did the Federal Reserve, which came about in 1913, replace that was created by Lincoln and other politicians of the mid-19th century?
Well, in a narrow sense, they replaced what was called national banking. And even to this day, in many cities, if you go to an old bank building, you'll see the words First National Bank, Second National Bank, Third National Bank chiseled onto those old stone porticos. But that was created in 1863. It was the brainchild of Salmon Chase, the Secretary of the Treasury under Lincoln, and very much a pet project of Lincoln's as well. What it replaced, these were national banks that distributed a uniform currency backed by sound assets, generally government bonds. What it replaced was almost no system at all. There were individual banks, hundreds of them, in the various states. They would pass out IOUs, you know, pieces of paper that said, someday they'd redeem them. These IOUs passed around as currency. If you were close to the bank, you might get close to 100% of the dollar for that note. The further you got from it, or if you cross state lines, you get a lot less. So, you know, we had, you know, something like 30 different systems of currency before the Civil War. Many of these banks were teetering on the edge of solvency. They were nothing of the scale that could finance either such a large, terrible war like the Civil War, or like what America was becoming, which was a modern industrial state.
Now, this might be a completely incorrect analogy, but is the system before the Civil War and the antebellum period somewhat similar to, let's say, the only currency we had was cryptocurrency? So there are some better known ones like Bitcoin or Ethereum. But then the Kourtney Kardashian-backed cryptocurrency is a little bit less reliable and solvent. Is that at all accurate, an analogy to the shakiness and unpredictability of the financial system?
It's okay as an analogy. I will point out that, you know, without commenting on what Abraham Lincoln thought about Bitcoin, these old banks, the state-chartered banks in the various states, they did have gold in their vaults. Now, some of them had more gold, some less. You know, some of them printed, you know, a lot of notes, some fewer, but there were assets behind the notes of these old banks, albeit in varying quantity and quality. As far as I know, there are no assets behind any of the cryptocurrencies.
Getting into more detail of the antebellum economic system beyond the, you know, wild west of banks and IOU notes and...
You know, there was no national currency. There was no national tax system. The only way the government got revenues was through a smattering of land sales and the tariff. Needless to say, once the war started, trade took a very big dip, and it wasn't nearly enough. So Lincoln and the Congress came up with a massive expansion of taxes, including income tax and a progressively calculated income tax, you know, higher rates on higher incomes. This was a first ever in the country, and it was revolutionary.
How else was the federal government involved, or more specifically, not involved in the antebellum period and other things like transportation, higher education, and other parts of our economy?
One other thing I'll point out was there was no national bank. There had been an ersatz central bank, the second bank in the United States, until Andrew Jackson got rid of it. The government was effectively separated from the banking system because of the ideology of the antebellum period. People didn't want the government to have anything to do with it, as a result of which, when the war started, the government was forbidden from borrowing in what currency did exist, the notes of these individual banks. So it was a, you know, for us in the modern age in which the government is so involved in the financial system, there was this very bizarre separation, which effectively prevented the government from raising funds. The other aspect in which the Civil War economic and really social transformations were revolutionary goes back to the beginnings of Abraham Lincoln's career. He didn't get into politics for reasons having much to do with slavery, although he was always opposed to slavery, viscerally and emotionally. Slavery was not a major issue when he started out in the 1830s. And it certainly, an anti-slavery platform wouldn't have gotten him very far in Illinois politics. But what started Lincoln out was the ideal of creating economic opportunity for people like himself, for people who'd risen effectively from a log cabin, as he did. Some of the issues are transportation. If you read the Lincoln's campaign biography that he wrote when he ran for president, he talks about driving a team of oxen over muddy and rutted roads. Internal improvements, the Build Back Better of the day, were terribly important, particularly to people in the interior of the country. It was cheaper to ship goods from England to New York than from places like Kentucky or Illinois. They desperately needed canals and railroads and better roads. They needed a tariff, particularly interior of the country, because of the competition from Europe. And that was a very strong part of Lincoln and the Republicans' platform. They did other things that expanded the social function of the federal government. They created a Department of Agriculture, which was a really seminal change. Agriculture was the largest industry of the country. This was the first government department that inserted a hand into private enterprise. This idea had been around before the Civil War, but the Democrats and the Southerners wanted nothing to do with it. Jefferson Davis made a very telling comment about this before the war when he was still a senator from Mississippi. He said, agriculture needs no teaching by Congress. And if you were Jefferson Davis, that was true, because Jefferson Davis had been given a cotton plantation by his brother. So he didn't need anything from Congress. But if you hadn't been gifted a plantation from your brother, maybe you did need help. What the Department of Agriculture did was it distributed seeds and it provided education to farmers about the crop rotations and so on. There's a very telling contrast between the philosophies North and South. On the one hand, if it's good for the president, he doesn't need anything. Nobody's going to have it. On the other hand, providing something, a little bit of help that all farmers can take advantage of. The Lincoln government passed the Homestead Act, which was, of course, to distribute land that would be free to farmers who worked and improved it for 5 years. You know, a seminal insertion of the federal government into really land reform. It legislated the Transcontinental Railroad, which had been debated for a decade or so, and because of disputes over which route it would take, had never gotten going. And this made a tremendous difference in the economy of the country. It really created the possibility of national markets for the first time. It created the Morrill Land Grant College Act, another bill that had been passed but vetoed before the war. What the Morrill Act did was create a system of federally financed colleges. And these wouldn't be like the Ivy League colleges that taught, you know, stuff like theology and Greek. They were going to teach practical arts, sciences, and the liberal arts for the middle class. It's just astounding to me. For one thing, they did this in the midst of Civil War, where they had plenty to occupy them. For another, fewer than 1% of Americans were in college in 1862 when this law was passed. Even intellectuals, for the most part, hadn't been to college. You know, Mark Twain never went to college. Walt Whitman never went to college. Many people, obviously Abraham Lincoln included, didn't finish high school, or in Lincoln's case, even elementary school. So the vision this took to underwrite a higher education for average Americans really gave a substance to what Lincoln said was the, and he said this in his first address to Congress, again, in the midst of the war, was the leading object of government. Those are his words. Again, what he said was to elevate the condition of men. This was a new idea. Government hadn't had the purpose of elevating the condition of men. Maybe Alexander Hamilton had that purpose, but certainly Jefferson didn't, and that hadn't been the shape or the function of government until the Civil War.
I'd love to go into the particulars of everything you mentioned there, particularly the Morrill Land Grant Act, which is near and dear to my heart, as my alma mater is Iowa State University, one of the first universities that benefit from this allotment of land. But these changes that you described, typically when swift and massive political change happens, it's because the older government undergoes some sort of stress test that it fails, and its current institutions and laws aren't up to the moment. We see this in World War I, World War II, Civil Rights Act, other monumental times of change in America's history. Could you describe in detail both the Union and the Confederacy, how they failed the stress tests of the Civil War, and in what ways, and you already mentioned that the banking system simply couldn't fund the Civil War for the Union, but what were other ways that the old system failed in the Union and the Confederacy that brought about the changes that you just referred to?
Well, one way, in the beginning, the military organization was state by state. Governors had control over naming generals. These were often given out to, you know, on a very partisan or favoritism basis. Individual states also requisitioned their own supplies, ammunition. They raised their own funds. In many cases, they were in competition with each other, raising money. Several states sent their own agents to England to buy Enfield rifles. So we had this very federalized, Balkanized system, and the quartermaster complained of it. It took quite a while to get all these functions nationalized, in the sense of, you know, under the scope of just the federal government. This was just, you know, the ideology of the country was extremely federal, in the sense of being federalized, state by state. And this was true even in the North. It took some time, and sort of a sea change developed. You can see it in some of the comments. When they passed the Banking Act that I discussed, the National Banking Act, it wasn't just to improve the financing. They conscientiously, self-consciously, that is, wanted to give the federal government control over the money supply and take it away from where it had been, which was in the states. John Sherman, the senator from Ohio, probably known to most Americans today for his later authorship of the Sherman Antitrust Act, but that was a good while later. Sherman said, "We want to make everything as national as possible so that we will love our country." And that was a very new idea, because the American founders, Jefferson and so on, had emphasized the primacy of the states. And as the need for national organization and leadership arose, as it often always does in wartime, the Republicans who were running the government were drawn to this idea of national organization, you know, at the federal level. At the Confederacy, it was quite different. The Confederacy was founded on the idea of states' rights, partly protect slavery. You go back as far back as the 1830s, when there were proposals for a federal canal building, which were vetoed. There was a politician from North Carolina who commented that a government that can build canals can more easily emancipate. So, they associated a strong federal government with a threat to slavery. And they also just didn't like the idea of the federal government intruding in their affairs, very much like the states that, in recent times have opposed things like national health care. And so the Confederacy was set up to remain localized. The Confederate government in Richmond never did get the power to tax on any kind of effective basis, which really crippled them. As the war went on, Davis realized that he needed more power. And he began to assume more powers and go to the Congress for more powers. Effectively, the need to fight a war was at odds with the underlying ethos that under which the Confederacy had been formed. And this greatly troubled some of his constituents. In North Carolina, there was a real movement to, if you can believe it, to secede from the secession, to secede from the Confederacy. And newspapers there said things like, I thought it was for freedom that we were joining the Confederacy. Freedom meaning freedom from big government. Jefferson tried to take over all of the business of running blockade runners because it was lucrative and because he wanted control over it. North Carolina had its own very lucrative blockade running service going, and they bitterly resisted this takeover. So this transition went much more smoothly in the North because it was more the ideology of the North. For the South, if they were going to have an overriding government in Richmond, what was the point of secession anyway?
Let's look into the particulars of the reforms that happened that you mentioned earlier. I suppose we could start with the Homesteading Act, and you noted that these reforms are happening during the Civil War, which is surprising they're able to get so much done when ostensibly some of these reforms don't have a connection to a wartime effort. And there have been times in the past when politicians have been criticized for using a crisis to pass things that they otherwise wouldn't be able to pass that really don't have a connection to the crisis at hand. And one famous quote was applied to Rahm Emanuel, Barack Obama's chief of staff, who said, "Never let a crisis go to waste," when he talked about reforms during the financial crisis of 2008-2009, without rehashing that episode. Lincoln, I don't think, or his advisors would perhaps have a cynical approach to, well, let's just pass all these reforms we wanted to anyway, that you'd think there'd be a reasonable connection to the needs of the time. So could we start with the Homestead Act? And
sure.
What were the purposes of passing this and what were the results of it?
The Homestead Act went back to Thomas Jefferson. He had this idea that within Virginia, they should give land to everybody who didn't have a certain amount of land. The idea was, they believed in creating mobility for people in the bottom. They believed in what we would call a middle-class society or a more egalitarian society. They wanted to create specifically a safety valve for crowded urban cities. They were very aware of this Malthusian threat of overcrowding in cities. The South had this ideology, by the way, that slavery was a better system because they'd done away with the potential for class conflict. Whereas in the North, they predict that we would have these terrible discord between industrialists and workers. And by the Civil War period, you already started to see strikes. It wasn't like the labor conflicts of the 1880s. But the Republican answer, to some extent, was there'll always be land in the West. So if the worker in an iron a factory or a railroad isn't happy, he can always go west. And following Horace Greeley's over-quoted dictum, it was also very much related to the Civil War in the sense that it was seen as a bulwark against creeping slavery. The contest in the Civil War, or that led the Civil War, the debate wasn't about abolition. There was no one among the Republicans, or at least no one who said publicly that they believed in abolition, and there was no apparent legal means, the Constitution, to get rid of slavery in the states where it existed. The contest was over Kansas, Nebraska, ultimately Wyoming territory and New Mexico and so on. Well, if you could fill the farmers, those territories with free, unenslaved farmers, you'd keep slavery out. Conversely, once there was slaving in any of those territories, free labor wouldn't want to go there and compete with slave labor. So this was very much seen as part of the slavery debate, as was the Agriculture Department for the same reason. To your point about not wasting a crisis, I think there was some of that. Some of these bills, as you said, couldn't have passed earlier. The Republicans were opportunistic in the sense that there was a need for revenue, which hadn't existed before. So they did things that wouldn't have happened. I think the one area where I'd accuse them of being a little cynical was the tariff. The tariff had been basically the sole support of the government before then. The government certainly needed more revenue during the Civil War, but they had more revenue from the income tax as well. And the tariff served another purpose as well. So one purpose was to generate revenue, but another purpose, if the rates got high enough, was strictly protectionist. It was just to keep foreign goods out and make life better for industrialists. And the during the Civil War, they raised the tariff three or four times, and they really raised it to exorbitant rates. I would argue above any kind of rates that were needed even to fund the government by the end of the war. And they did it just to set up this sort of protectionist wall that benefited Northeastern industry to the great detriment of farming regions and Western regions and after the war of the South, because they, of course, were consumers of manufactured goods. And I would argue that that was exploiting a crisis for partisan grounds, and that led to the post-war alliance between Republicans and big business. Remember, the Republicans came as an upstart party. They were reformers. By the 1880s, they didn't look like reformers so much. And I think the Civil War tariff was the beginning of that.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. You know, too, that Lincoln instituted the first income tax, which I've heard other sources attribute at the beginning of the income tax of the early 20th century. So what's the discrepancy between these two beginnings, and what did Lincoln's income tax look like?
Well, what his what it looked like, it was taxed over income of $600. First, it was $800, and they lowered the threshold to $600. It was 5% at that level, and then 10%, and then if you had a really high incomes, there was one higher bracket. Very few people reached those upper brackets. It took in quite a lot. They had no idea how much money it was going to raise. They had no data on people's incomes. But it took in tens and then ultimately over $100 million a year. It was quite successful. The Republicans wanted to continue it after the war, but it was in conflict with the tariff because as the government needed less money, one of them either had to be reduced or to go. There just wasn't the need for it. As I said before, the Eastern industrialists were very much in favor of the tariff because it not only raised revenue, it served the purposes of insulating their own particular private industrial needs by walling out a competition. So the income tax was allowed to lapse in the early 1870s. The Congress needed it again, but I should point out that the Bureau, the Revenue Bureau, which was a forerunner of the IRS, continued. And that remained in place right through that is the IRS that we have today. In the 1890s, an income tax was reinstated. It was thrown out by the Supreme Court the next year, but that led to a constitutional amendment. And in the first year of the Wilson presidency, the income tax was reinstated for good.
The next part, the Morrill Land Grant Act, I think this is incredibly influential, not just on the United States, but global education, which copies what universities become after this, regardless of the halo effect of Ivy League. And even Ivies have copied what universities became after the Morrill Land Grant Act. Could you describe this, why it was passed at this time and the effect that it had?
Yeah, but you went to Iowa State. I'm also a Morrill graduate at Cornell University. In fact, I spent a lot of time in Morrill Hall, the history hall, which still stands on the Arts Quad at Cornell. Morrill was a middle-class striver, very typical of the people, the Civil War generation. These were not plantation owners. They weren't wealthy men at all, or at least they didn't start out that way. Many of them started out quite poor. He clerked for a couple of stores, made himself some money, invested quite successfully in railroads and iron and other industries. built himself a beautiful library up in Vermont where he lived. But he always regretted something. He regretted that he had not been able to afford going to college. And this stuck with him. And so when he had the chance, he got this act put through. I really think of all the Civil War changes, this is my favorite. It democratized education. It democratized the purpose of education, not just teaching highly refined subjects, as I said, like theology and so on, but what they called then engineering and the practical arts. It used a resource that America had plenty of, land. They were financed by endowing them with land. The only controversy in the act was that the land, of course, had to come from the West, because that's where the federal government's land was. And Western states weren't so happy about giving their land to Eastern states like New York, which were wealthier, to build universities like Cornell and so on. But after limitations on how much land would come from any state, and of course, by that time, it wasn't really state land, it was all federal land, they got it through. And, there are a lot of federal programs that run into trouble. We can talk about the Transcontinental Railroad, which got the railroad done, but it's expensive, terrible corruption, terrible scandal. The Morrill Act, really, I do think, lived out Morrill's dream of making the country better through the ages.
Right. It meant that you would have departments like the mechanical arts, which become engineering departments. At the time, that type of scientific approach was seen as a little bit gauche, that you were a tinkerer or a tradesman. You weren't doing what someone would be trained at a university to study physics or mathematics or the
athletics. Yes, college wasn't for that. College, it was just unheard of. In the South, particularly, college existed to put a sheen of a refinement on people who were already wealthy. In the North as well, college was almost exclusively for the wealthy. And, I think the strength of a democracy is the strength of his middle class. And in an age of technology today, we can appreciate that, that has to start with our level, the general level of education. So I think it was a terrific bill. It was later extended to bring in Indian Native Americans from the reservations and make sure that they were included, which was particularly needed because many of the lands had come from various tribes. Colleges were extended to the South after the war. Unfortunately, during the period of Jim Crow, the South would not permit integrated Morrill Act colleges. And the federal government did an end run around this by creating black schools as well as white schools in the South. And that was regrettable, but better to have them than to not have them.
So anything we think of today as STEM education, I don't know if you agree or not, but really comes from this. So if we imagine MakerBots and 3D printers and these types of charter schools, it comes from this vision of hands-on education that's practical in engineering and agriculture and other things that merge the world of the abstract sciences to practical industry that could build up a nation. Does that sound accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the history of Caltech. And anytime you say anything, someone's going to find something that'll prove you're wrong. But, the Lincoln government also brought the government into scientific research for the first time. The first funding for research, that was in the Civil War. Certainly there was a seed money for the latter, immense involvement in things like the space program. So if you put those two together, the government today plays a leading role in all sorts of research and both directly and through its support of colleges. So it's just a seminal change. I wonder what Jefferson would have thought of it, because Jefferson was such a tinkerer and so taken by improving crop yields and in architecture and the sciences. In his day, government wasn't involved, but I imagine that he would have taken an interest in this.
That's a very interesting point, because this approach of federally funded universities, he wouldn't have been supportive of, yet it produced the type of educated Yale man that he did like. So in a perfect Jeffersonian world, we're all George Washington Carver, who just sort of observes nature and becomes a scientist, but we don't all have the mind of George Washington Carver, so not really possible.
And he did sponsor the Lewis and Clark expedition, which was a 3,000-mile research project. So,
well, speaking of transportation, you mentioned the Transcontinental Railroad, and that's the of course, biggest result we think of when we think of federal funding of transportation. But how did that play out? You mentioned corruption with it. And then what were other large projects that came about as a result of Lincoln's initiative and other politicians?
Well, they chartered both the Union Pacific to build west from Omaha and the Central Pacific to build east from Sacramento. And of course, the Omaha line was connected by various feeders to various major cities in the east, and the same thing going west in California to San Francisco. The building went fine. It went on schedule. It was financed by federal bonds and by land. All these programs were financed one way or another by land. That was what the federal government, that was the currency that it had in such abundance. The federal government proved a poor steward, though, in one respect, in the supervision of the company, particularly Union Pacific, that were doing the building. The Union Pacific formed a shadow company, the Credit Mobilier, through which it contracted to build the railroad. The Credit Mobilier bought off a lot of Congress. They paid irresponsibly high amounts to, you know, way high. I don't think they even bid them out in many cases to build the railroad. This was exposed, of course, in the Grant administration, and it was a terrible scandal, and deservedly so, and it tarred a great many reputations. But the railroad got built. It was very close to Lincoln's heart. In fact, when it got going, when the act was being legislated, he said he looked forward to riding it himself when he left the White House. Of course, he never got there. But, you know, even as late as the 1860s, it was several weeks' journey to cross the plains and the Rocky Mountains to California by stagecoach. It was still a perilous journey. It effectively shut off most people from going there. And this reduced it to 4 days. And in the Civil War period, you know, and we talked about not letting a crisis go to waste, one fear was that if the South broke away, the country would disintegrate, that New York might break away. New York, for a time, had a very copperhead, very pro-Southern mayor. There was talk that New York City would break away and that California might break away. And part of the what gave the Transcontinental Railroad urgency was this was a way of locking California, both physically and psychically, into the Union.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. With all these different far-reaching government reforms, were there any failures that you see? And by failure, I mean either a program that Lincoln and others wanted to pass but couldn't pass, or they did pass, but it wasn't implemented to meet the needs of the time, or perhaps it was completely unnecessary and maybe even became a boondoggle.
Well, yes. You know, one reform that was much talked about by Thaddeus Stevens, the fiery and very anti-slavery congressman of Pennsylvania, and by Salmon Chase, the Secretary of the Treasury, and somewhat by Lincoln, was the need to provide for the freedmen, the freed slaves. Freedmen, as they were called then. And some, including Stevens and to some extent Salmon Chase, everybody realized that there would have to be a period of transition and some way of integrating people who had never been allowed to participate in the market system. And what many people sought was some basis of giving them land so that they would have an economic stake in the country post-war. And the Freedmen's Commission was set up. And there were some tentative attempts to do that. There were islands off the coast of Carolina, the Sea Islands, where they were liberated early because they fell into Union hands early, and they began to sign up for land. But as it happened, as the war ended, the old plantation owners came back, and they found themselves really not getting a lot of land. Broadly, the land reform never really went through. Thaddeus Stevens said, if we don't do this, we shall deserve the execration of the ages. And the freedmen were left, most of them, as sharecroppers, which became a kind of indentured servitude under the most onerous and really unfree terms. It was a sort of a shadow slavery. I think that was, you know, that was a real failure and a real miss to emancipate the slaves, but not give them a real economic foothold, some seed capital in the new country.
This is a hypothetical, but I actually had a discussion with other history podcasters a month or two ago on if you could save anyone in history from an early death, who would you save? I chose Lincoln because of the failure of Reconstruction, which you alluded to, and that I don't know if Lincoln could have made everything turn out well, but he could have hardly done worse than Johnson. Do you think that Lincoln would have been able to shepherd things in a way so that Freedmen and others could have received land and Reconstruction could have not been a catastrophic failure?
It's very tough. The country was very eager for peace, North and South. Lincoln was very eager for peace. In one of his few correspondences between the war's end and his death 5 days later, he assured an Alabaman he had no wish to harm in any head, meaning Southerners' heads. He said he wanted Southerners back in their shops and their farms. I think he believed that unity and commerce across state lines would be a healing solve for the country. He wanted a quick restoration of bringing the South back into the Union. You know, although he certainly wasn't Andrew Johnson, he didn't have the mindset, say, of Thaddeus Stevens, who wanted to uproot the South economically and politically after the war. James Lowell, the poet, assessed Lincoln's genius for leading. This is in 1864, before the election. And he said he leads so gently, he leads the public so gently, he almost seems to follow it. And we saw this in the debates about slavery, where he moved very incrementally, first with things like a weak Confiscation Act, and then a stronger one, and then emancipation in the District of Columbia, and then emancipation of slaves in points under rebellion, but not in areas that were loyal, and finally with the 13th Amendment, you know, complete abolition. To envision Lincoln embarking on a radical and, you know, highly disputatious restoration period, you know, he would have been challenged. I think anybody would have been challenged. He wouldn't have been, of course, he would have only been president, presumably, for another 4 years. Presumably, he would have had better results than Andrew Johnson. But the really terrible setbacks didn't really come to the Grand Era when you begin having, and after the Grand Era, when you begin having attacks on black elected officials and lynchings and so on. You know, by the late 1870s and 1880s, Lincoln presumably would have been long out of office in any event. I think the missed opportunity maybe was otherwise. We needed a way to make the South feel welcome back in the Union with something other than soldiers or something besides soldiers. The country was awfully tired of fighting. I think had we attempted to extend the Civil War type reforms down South with something like a Marshall Program to the defeated areas so that the South would have felt that there was something in it for them to be part of this new, more federal system, more national system, they might not have gone back so much to this idea of basically this demagogic strategy of pleasing poor whites by repressing blacks and keeping them at an even lower station, which was the planter strategy in the antebellum period and became the Southern strategy during the Jim Crow era. But we didn't do anything like that. And that might have been beyond the possible scope of the government back then, but that formula after World War II worked pretty well. It was the idea then was to persuade the defeated or the formerly conquered countries of Europe that they would do better under Western style democratic capitalism than obviously under some Russian form of communism. And the idea in the 1860s and 70s would have been to convince Southerners that they would do better under a prosperous, modern, and biracial democracy than under some return to semi-slavery. But we didn't make that effort. I don't think one person, even Abraham Lincoln, could have done it.
It's one of the great historical what-ifs, so I appreciate your perspective on that. Well, tying up the theme of your book, I'm curious, even though we mentioned at the top of this discussion that many of the government reforms instituted during the Civil War were replaced in the early 20th century, which reforms would you say are still with us today, and how did the reforms of Lincoln change the trajectory of the United States?
Well, obviously, the railroads still with us. and the Morrill Act are still with us. You know, fiat currency went but came back and is very much still with us. They worried about inflation then, and we're certainly worrying about it today. I think about 10% of the land of the United States was ultimately homesteaded. Is that the homesteaders have long since claimed their land, but the legacy is still with us. The income tax is with us again. We're all going to be reminded of that next month, April 15th. I think the biggest legacy is the idea of the federal government as the guardian of the nation's future and the nation's prosperity. That wasn't really an idea pre the Civil War. There may be a few people that had the idea, like Alexander Hamilton, but he hadn't really won out. The federal government up to 1860 was much more the Jeffersonian idea, the government that governs least. And Lincoln and his allies in Congress brought this idea that the federal government would be the engine of prosperity and of growth and take a very active hand in the country's economic affairs. And we certainly see that today, more than ever. And that traces back to 1860s.
Well, we think about the changes that the Civil War brought about in terms of the Emancipation Proclamation or the defeat of the Confederacy. But I think you make a strong argument here that the financing of the Civil War had many other important impacts as well that affect us today.
Yes, of course, the Emancipation Proclamation and the abolition of slavery is right up there front and center as well.
Right. Well, there's a lot more to unpack in the story. And for listeners who want to see that in your book, the name of it is Ways and Means, Lincoln, His Cabinet, and the Financing of the Civil War. Roger, thank you for joining us.
Scott, it was a real pleasure to take this deep dive and good talking to you.
All right, that is all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes for this and all my other episodes and include sources, maps, or other relevant information, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. Parthenon is the name of the podcast network that History Unplugged is a part of, along with other great history shows like James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. This really helps the show grow. The second thing is to join our membership program on Patreon. And if you do so, you can get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog of the show, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening and see you next time.